You are listening to the Mythmaker Podcast Network.
The only book of Castaneda's that I've read is that is the first one, The Teaching of Don Juan. And it's one of the most exciting books and one of the most exciting explorations in anthropology that's taken place. This whole experience of an inward world is what I find there, that we're all capable of having. But I don't think that for a modern person, this is the best and most productive kind of way to build a life. I think it was very bold of him, very brave of him, and admirable of him in the way of exploring to find what lies behind what we do know about shamanism and the mysteries of primitive initiations. But we are in a world that's a totally different world from that of the primitive societies, and this, if it is to be taken as a guide for contemporary life. Now, I don't know the next book, do you see, so I don't know what I'm talking about. But in relation to that book there, it was, to me, one of the most exciting books I read last year. And I have the other on my shelf, but I've been too much involved in other things to pick it up yet. And I intend to. And another reality is exactly what I'm talking about. There is a reality beyond the sphere of waking consciousness, which is down in the deep dream state area, which is discovered. It's discovered by taking LSD. It's discovered by having a psychotic crackup. And that's the area that he got into. There were some very sophisticated answers that Don Juan gave him when he asked questions. That wonderful time when he was turned into a crow and flew and met a lot of other crows and flew around and then came back, was found in a ditch. He said to Don Juan, "Did I really fly?" And Don Juan said, "Yes, you did." And he asked, "If two of my classmates had been present, would they have seen me flying?" And Don Juan said, "That's an irrelevant question." Okay, we're in another reality, you see. There is a reality of the spirit, of the psyche, and all. That is a reality. And the experiences there are experiences of flight in the space of your own interior space world. And something like that is the world that he was exploring there. I think a great deal of what we're experiencing today in our lives of interest in these mysteries of the depths is the result of that LSD fashion a few years ago. I think that it was a terrible disaster for many people who got involved in it and knocked themselves out and brought on psychoses and so forth. But what it showed in a public way was that that zone is there. It's down there. And psychosis is not simply some crazy thing at all. It's a plunge into the abyss that's there. And if you don't know anything about that abyss, you'll get there in time. What is the reason for the nervous breakdown that is so characteristic of men who have retired from business? It's that that psyche, that energy of the psyche, which was engaged out there in the fierce task of winning, is now released. It goes in into a zone full of these monsters, full of these demons, which you should become acquainted with much earlier in life and say, "Hi there, Charlie. Wasn't it fun last time?" It's all down there, and this is the world that this chap is. But there are some very mysterious things in that book. I mean, he's gone past anything you can explain, and it's terribly exciting. I think the world lives on crazy things. And the economics turn up later. Somebody finds out how to cash in on it some way or other later. You can depend on that. The fellow will come along who tells you what the use of it all is. I understand the products are turning up in our kitchens now. Certain kinds of metal that's easy to cook on and clean and all that kind of thing. Their values come out of this. It's funny. When you want to do something really wonderful and you want a grant in aid for it, you have to explain it in terms that are not those of the project at all, but you have to make somebody think you're going to give him something he wants. Meanwhile, you get something interesting done. Anyone who's written out an application for a grant in aid knows about that. Well, this is a very interesting thing. In all other cultures of the world, the serpent represents the energy of life bound to the world. The serpent sheds its skin and is born again, so represents the power of life to shed death, thus living in the world. And the serpent thus represents the health power of life. On our doctor's staff, we still have the serpents, the caduceus of Hermes. Hermes is the Lord who leads men to the wisdom of rebirth and to illumination of eternal life. And the serpent is this symbol. Now, the earliest evidence of the serpent as a divine figure, I mean a figure that has a symbolic value of this kind that I know about, is on a buckle made of mammoth tusk that was found in a place in Siberia called Malta. It dates from about 15,000 BC. It's late Magdalenian. And there are four serpents there. Think of the serpent in the American Indian tradition. Now, the rattlesnake is a terribly dangerous serpent animal, but it's this very important symbol, because life is dangerous. It's the symbol of life. Serpent looks fluid, like water, but it has that fiery tongue. It always looks like an ever-burning flame. The fire in the water is the energy of water that brings forth life, fire water. That's why spiritus liquor is always a divine drink and always has been known to be that until rather recently. The word whiskey is simply the Gaelic word for water of life. The serpent is a creature of this same mystery. The earliest image of the caduceus that we know comes from a cup of King Gudea of Lagash, dates from 2000 BC, almost exactly. The date for the third period of New Ur is 1250 to 1950 BC, so it's just 2000 BC. And what this shows are two lion birds, kind of cherubim, drawing apart the portals of a gate, revealing a shrine. And the center of the shrine is a rod, the axis mundi, the world axis. And up the sides of it are these two serpents intertwining. And remarkably, they cross seven times. Now, when you look at the Kundalini Sushumna and the two nerves, the Ida and Pingala, they cross seven times. And the energy of the Kundalini is called the serpent power. And it's the spirit of life in life. It's the energy of the spirit in the body. And in most of us, it lies in a rather inert condition. This is the condition of the first, what's called the first chakra, Muladhara. At that level, the energy is simply gripping life. It has no zeal for life. It's just hanging on. When I think of this Muladhara and the way the energy of life is at that level, I think of the dragon. We know about dragons. Dragons like to guard things. And what they guard are, and we know, people studied the dragon for a long, long time. This is the serpent, the winged serpent is the dragon. He guards gold and beautiful girls, and he can't think what to do with either of them. All he does is guard. And there are people like that, and we call them creeps. Those are people living with the spiritual serpent power on the lowest level. Then it comes to the second level, which is at the level of the sex. At this level, people have Freudian psyches. Everything means sex. Their success is sex. Their failure is sex. Their frustration is sex. And if they're blocked entirely, then they go to work somewhere. And you have what Freud calls a sublimation. You have civilizations growing. That kind of thing. The whole Freudian psychology is based on the second chakra. The third level is called Manipura. This is at the level of the navel. Person at this stage wants to eat and consume everything to himself. His will is the will to power. This is an Adlerian psychology. What is called Anahata, is the awakening of the spiritual life. One hears the sound that is not made by any two things striking together, the sound of the energy of the universe, of which all things are precipitations. This is the sound Om. And Anahata is the name of this chakra, what the word means, not hit. Hearing the sound that is not made by things hitting together. This is the awakening of awe that I spoke of as the awakening of the spiritual life. And this is the virgin birth. The human spirit is born in the heart. The Indians say at this point, the hands of the devotee touch the feet of the god. You are beginning to awake as a human being instead of as a mere animal. And this is the awakening of Dante's Vita Nuova. What had formerly been viewed on the level of chakra 2 is now viewed in the dimension of the spirit. After that, the goal is to experience this directly, not only through things, hearing the sound in the world, but directly. And so you move up to the next level. The serpent is moving up. And at this level, the level of the word, animals can't speak. We're in the human level now. At the throat, this is called Vishuddha, which means purgation. You are going to purge your senses of their merely animal relationship and see things in another mode. And you are bringing the energy of chakra 3, namely violence, not against the world, but against yourself. My body will suffer. I'm trying to purge my body of its way of relating to the experiences of life. Then the serpent comes to this level here, which is called agya, right between the eyes, and the sound is heard. And the Lord of all forms is beheld. That is to say, the second chakra, namely the erotic, has found its proper object, God. God is what is to be seen through all the beauty and all the love of the world as the source. And in our mythology, the Christian mythology, we stop at that point. This is the place where the soul beholds its proper object, subject, object. Now, Ramakrishna, speaking of this, speaks of it as though there were a pane of glass between the subject and the object. The goal of love, of course, the ultimate goal, is to be one with the beloved. But here you can't be. The subject beholds the object. And in our tradition, we say, you are not God. You can't be one with God. You can only relate to God. Aquinas says that in heaven the souls behold the beatific vision but do not understand it. Now, the goal of the Oriental mystic and of many Western mystics who have been anathematized as heretics is to go past that stage. This is heaven. To withdraw that glass between subject and object and be united to the deity. The great Sufi mystic Halaj discusses this in the following way. He says, it is as though a moth at night saw a flame, and a flame within a lantern, and it comes and bangs itself on that glass and shatters and smashes its wings and all. And next morning goes back to its friends and says, what a wonderful thing I saw last night. And they say, well, you don't look the better for it. And this is the condition of the ascetic, zealous to be united with his deity. And then the next night he goes back and finds his way through and indeed becomes not only one with the light, but the light. And this is what happens when the Kundalini reaches the seventh chakra, the Sahasrara, the thousand petal lotus of crown of the head. This is the symbolism of the serpent here. It is that energy of life, which in its lowest level is just the crawling serpent on earth, but can be elevated to become the shining golden serpent or the winged serpent, the dragon in full glory. Now, what has happened in the biblical tradition is a late patriarchal culture comes in to this same context of myths. And this serpent power is all in connection. This is my talk for the women's lib. This is all connected with the goddess mythologies. The serpent is the consort of the mother goddess Earth herself, who can herself assume a serpent form. That's who these serpents are. But you have a patriarchal culture coming in which rejects the cults of the earth. The cults of the earth are operating on symbols that are those of the second chakra, the sexual symbol of fertility, fructification, and reproduction, and so forth. The patriarchal societies come in on the third level, the level of violence. Cities that you did not build, you shall inhabit. Fields that you did not plant, you shall reap. Words, my dearly beloved, of the book of Numbers. The idea is to reject the cults of the land. The whole sense of the religious history of the Old Testament is Yahweh against the cults of the land. And one monarch after another does evil in the sight of Yahweh. He makes offerings on the mountaintops. And the poor old Josiah's time, when he starts clearing out the temple, what does he find in there? He finds images of the goddess. He finds the temple prostitutes. He finds the sacred horse of the sun. Among other things, he finds a serpent named Nahishtun, which is supposed to be the serpent that Moses is supposed to have cast in bronze. Moses, a bronze caster, in the middle of the desert. Funny things occur in traditional texts. But what he finds there is all the imagery of the cults of the land. And so we go against it again. This leads to the degradation of the serpent, the cursing of the serpent. Those cults are the abomination, but they keep coming back. In the time of the Maccabees, that conflict between the Judah and the Alexandrian Epiphanes, the emperor, the Hellenistic emperor. In the graves of the Jewish soldiers, there are found these amulets. And what are on the amulets? Pictures of Yahweh with serpent legs. What's known as the Angripi, the serpent came right back. The deity takes over the qualities of the deity whom he has defeated. Yahweh is a new deity who defeats the old serpent deity, and the serpent power then adheres to Yahweh himself in a certain way. He becomes a very complicated, ambiguous figure, just as Zeus does in Greece. He comes in the same way as a patriarchal figure, slays the serpents, and appears himself as a serpent in the later arts. So much for the serpent. Well, I think it's about time now for us all to raise our kundalini, you know?